This episode is brought to you by the Michigan Cherry Committee. Learn about the wonderfully tart Montmorency cherry at choosecherries.com.
Hey there, HRN listeners. This is Harry Rosenblum, host of Feast Your Ears. I know that news about COVID-19 and the coronavirus has made a lot of people nervous about getting sick. This collective unease has already had a big impact on our restaurant and food communities, especially in New York's Chinatowns. We hope that now more than ever, our listeners will join us in supporting restaurants and the hospitality industry at large. Many of the restaurants we love are small, independent businesses. That means that even one or two bad weeks can put them in jeopardy of cutting staff, limiting hours, or even having to close for good. As long as we're still able, we should go out to eat and support our favorite restaurants. I think it's also great to remember that hospitality professionals are really good at hygiene and food safety practices. Long before there were guides all over the news about how to properly wash your hands, they were already experts at hygiene. Guests' health is tantamount to successful hospitality in any restaurant. And even if you don't want to go out, you can still support restaurants by ordering delivery, buying gift cards, and giving them some extra love on social media. What better way to handle a crisis than by supporting those in our own community? If we don't support them now, they might not be there when this crisis is over. Join HRN in supporting restaurants during this time, especially our friends in Chinatowns around the country. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Inside Julia's Kitchen, the podcast, the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts. I'm your host, Todd Shulkin, the Foundation's Executive Director. Our show takes you inside the Foundation's world to meet the talented people we have the good fortune of learning from all the time. On today's show, we welcome one of the world's most acclaimed pastry chefs, Dominique Ancel. In today's episode, we'll talk to Dominique about what it takes to make great pastry, his new book, Everyone Can Bake, and we'll hear Dominique's Julia moment. Stay with us. We'll be right back. As always, we launch the conversation with an inspiration from Julia. We already know that Julia really valued learning from the experts, especially chefs. She also spent a lot of time learning about, writing about, teaching about, and perfecting making French pastry and bread. She really wanted to master the technique and duplicate the delights she'd experienced at the best bakeries in France. Mastering the Art of French Cooking Volume 2 famously has a nearly 20-page-long recipe for making French bread. Julia managed to trim it down to a scant 10 pages in The Way to Cook, including photos, but that book actually has a bigger trim size. In any case, Julia once said, there are only four great arts, music, painting, sculpture, and ornamental pastry. Now, she said that with tongue in cheek, and I think she might have been quoting someone else, but what she was alluding to was the tremendous skill and precision, as well as artistry, that it takes to be a great pastry chef. Like all cooking done well, it's a magic mix of science and art, but pastry takes it to another level because the artistry needs to be met with accuracy. Someone who has garnered a lot of recent acclaim for his innovation and creativity in baking is pastry chef Dominique Ancel. A James Beard Award winner and owner of Dominique Ancel Bakeries in New York, London, Los Angeles, and now Hong Kong, Chef Dominique has created some of the most talked about recent pastry creations, including most famously the Cronut, as well as the Cookie Shot, Frozen S'more, and Blossoming Hot Chocolate. Named the world's best pastry chef in 2017, as well as the most innovative people under 40 by Business Insider, Dominique has already been bestowed with France's second highest honor, the L'Ordre du Mérite Agricole. His first cookbook, Dominique Ancel, The Secret Recipes, was published in 2014. Before opening his first bakery in New York City in 2011, his star rose as a pastry chef at our good friend chef Daniel Boulud's flagship New York restaurant, Danielle. He joins us today to encourage baking know-how and give us a sneak peek at his new book, Everyone Can Bake, Simple Recipes to Master and Mix. Welcome to the podcast, Dominique.
Thank you, Todd. Thank you for having me.
Well, we're really glad you could join us. So I want to start with like a very broad question, almost maybe philosophical. Did you choose pastry, or did you find that it chose you?
Well, for me, you know, I grew up in a small, humble family in the north of France. And I, growing up, my parents didn't have much money to send me to school. So very early on, when I was 15, I had to decide what to do because I couldn't keep on going to school. So I decided to work in the kitchen, thinking that it was going to be easy, so thinking that it was something that I would enjoy. And I started working in the kitchen as a chef. So I was washing dishes, cleaning pots and pans. And my first year was actually pretty rough. It was very difficult, very challenging, working long hours, very stressful. And it's only after the second year that I started like enjoying what I did. I've definitely learned a lot in the kitchen. You know, some sort of discipline and strictness into working, but also something that I apply in my personal life, which made me a better teenager, I think.
And was the kitchen you started in a pastry or bakery, or was it a regular sort of restaurant or catering kitchen?
So it was a restaurant, a small restaurant next to a theater, and I was one of the young cook there. So I was actually trained as a chef, savory chef, when I first began my career. Which is something I enjoy a lot as well. And later on, I switched to do more pastry, which I love now.
And tell us more about that switch. Was there an aha moment, or the pastry chef was sick and they put you on the line, or what happened?
Well, actually, when you start in the kitchen in France, of course, you start washing dishes, cleaning pots, like sweeping the floor. I was a young kid. After a little while, they put you doing all the appetizer. So when you do the appetizer, you also do desserts. It's one of the first stations that you learn. Just like everything that's cold, all the cold plates. And when I was a savory chef, of course, you know, when you cook with your heart. I always say you cook with your heart. You season, you test everything. Everything changes all the time. So there's nothing too precise. But as a young chef, when I was given a recipe, and when I had to look at every instructions, pull the scale out of the toolbox, and now start measuring precisely, taking a thermometer to check temperature and everything. Now I discover new skills, which is a lot more scientific, a lot more organized, a lot more precise, and I instantly loved it. I loved the fact that everything I was doing in the kitchen will come out like perfect every single time, and I learned that. Science was behind it, and this is when I discovered baking.
I see. And did you? And how did you end up getting to New York and to working for Daniel Boulud?
Well, I worked in France for my majority of my career, and I worked in Paris for close to 10 years. When I was in Paris, I worked for Fauchon. Fauchon is one of the greatest retailer. We have a huge pastry section, one of the best pastry shop in Paris as well. I worked for them for 10 years, and during this time, I started as a cook, as a pastry cook there. So I was one of 30 people that were hired, and they told us they would keep 3 people after the 3 months we were hired for. And 2 weeks before the end, they told us they will only keep one person. And I was the person selected to stay in the team. So I was supposed to stay for 4 months. Ended up spending close to 8 years at Fauchon. And I started as a cook, the lowest grade in the kitchen. When I left, I was the corporate chef in charge of the expansion of the brand for pastry internationally. So I love traveling. I love like going to different places, learn about different cultures, and setting up shops. And after my time at Fauchon, I decided it was time for me to go and do something else. So Daniel Boulud reached out to me. Daniel is one of the greatest chefs in New York and United States. He has a fine dining restaurant called Daniel in New York City, and he asked me to come join the team and know a little bit about New York. And New York, of course, as a French kid, that's a big city, the city where nothing ever stops, where there's always something to learn, always new restaurants. So I was very, very excited about the opportunity. I came to New York with my two suitcases, working for Danielle, and I instantly loved it. So I stayed at Danielle for close to 6 years. And in 2011, I decided to open my own shop, to open my own small bakery in New York City.
And is it somewhat the experience that you had working with Fauchon, which is a retailer, that kind of gave you that combination with Danielle and all that other experience? Is that sort of what kind of made you be in a position where you thought, oh, one thing you'd like to do is have your own bakeries?
Yes, it's a really good question. Working in a restaurant and working in a retail shop is a complete different job. Even as a pastry chef, I will say when you're a pastry chef in a restaurant, you learn to work with the season. So you learn about the fruits and the seasonality and what you can get and when. You have to change the menu every week, every few weeks. You have to introduce new dishes. When you're a pastry chef in a retail and in a bakery, it's a lot different. You have to plan ahead of time for holidays. You have to organize yourself. I would say like better, differently. You have to think that everything you make is going to be sitting in a pastry case. It's going to be still. And I always tell people the pastries in the retail environment are the stars of a silent movie because they speak for themselves. You only look at them just for a quick second, and you interact with them like very quickly. So they have to be beautiful. You have to be like attracting your eyes and your look. And when you're in a restaurant, the opposite is that you have a server that comes to your table, so he can tell you any stories about why we use different shapes in the plates and why the colors are intermixed and the flavors and textures. So it's a lot more poetic to be in a restaurant, so when you have someone to introduce you to the dish. But when you're in retail, it's a little bit more challenging, but it's still possible to do things that are eye-catching and also delicious and interactive and memorable.
Well, I think that brings us to a good place. I'm sure you're maybe a little tired of answering this question, but I don't think we can speak to you without talking about the Cronut, because I can't think of a new food that was such a sensation or talked about by probably, you know, more people that could connect it with your name or your bakery. But so given what you were just talking about in particular, it was that kind of where some of the inspiration from the Cronut came, which is this idea that the products have to speak to the customers from the display shelf?
So the Cronut came about during one of our meeting with the team. When I first opened my bakery, I wanted to change the menu very often. Which is a little bit the habits of work from a pastry chef in a restaurant. I love changes, and I love things that are fresh made, and I want to bring some of these to my bakery that I recently opened. So I opened the bakery in 2011 with only 4 employees, 2 people in the kitchen and 2 people in the front of the house to make coffees and serve pastries. And that's it. We had no dishwasher, no one to clean, no managers. It was just like me and just 4 people. So a very, very small team. And I remember one of the meeting with the team, someone had suggested to do a donut for a Mother's Day. And I told them that I didn't have a recipe for a donut, but I'll come up with something. So, of course, I'm French. I grew up eating croissants, which I love the textures. I love the flaky layers. I love the tiny air bubble and the flavors, and I love all of the aspects of the croissant, and I want to introduce it into a shape of a donut. So I created the Cronut. It took me over 3 months to perfect the recipe. It's not just a croissant that's fried. It's a lot more complex than this. It uses similar techniques, which is a fermentation and what we call lamination, the technique of overlapping butter and dough hundreds of times to make all these like beautiful layers. So it uses similar techniques, but it's a recipe that was, refined and tweaked so many times. So after 3 months, I was happy with the result. I put the Cronut on the menu on the weekend of Valentine's Day, and I remember a blogger from New York, snapped a quick photo with his phone, put it on his blog, and he called me the next day. The article he posted on his blog went viral. And at the time, I was only sleep just like 3 or 4 hours a night with a small team in a small shop. And I was like, listen, I'm happy for you. going to go to sleep. He was like, no, you don't understand. This article went viral. I had an increase of traffic of 300% on my website and over 140,000 link in just a few minutes, in a few hours, sorry. And the article went viral. So once again, I was like, I'm really happy for you. I'm willing to get some rest. He was like, listen, just make more tomorrow. I think you're going to be busy. And of course, by day two, we had like 40, 50 people. By day three, we had over 150 people waiting outside before we opened the shop. And this is when it went viral. And I still don't know what happened exactly or how it happened so fast. But at the time, it was just like the word was spreading across the country and across the world, and people were coming just from every part of the world to get the coconut. And it was very overwhelming because at the time I still had only 4 employees. It was a small, very humble bakery, which it still is. We don't have too much space. My kitchen is very, very tiny. I have one table only in the kitchen. And I was doing my best to keep up with the volume and also keep up with the quality, because it's more important for me.
And so now I think the quantity of production for Cronuts and the locations that you have that sell them is kind of controlled. But it sounds like that wasn't by design. You never had any, it's been by design, presumably through a learning process or a compensating process. But it was it originally something you just thought you'd have for 3 months and then move on from?
Originally, it's something I wanted to put on the menu for the weekend. And, it went viral, so we could never stop. So what we've done a lot of beautiful things with the cornet. I've raised like hundreds of thousands of dollars to fight against hunger in New York City by auctioning off cornet with different charities here. And it's amazing, you know, I've raised over $100,000 selling, auctioning off less than 24 cornet, only 24 cornet. And we change the flavor every single month, and we have never ever repeated the same flavor twice. And it's a rule of ours, which is challenging. So we every month is a new flavor, every first of each month, and even across the world, across different locations, we never repeat the same flavor. So we always come up with some new combination of flavors using like herbs, spices, using different fruits, different chocolates, but it's always unique and original.
Wow. And so, it's really in some ways that Dominique Ansel bakeries are the house that the Cronut built, which is a very unexpected thing, I'm sure. But has the success of the Cronut and thus of your operation, has that changed your approach to being a pastry chef? Or how have you moved forward from that fateful day with the blogger?
I think that the Cronut was an eye-opening and a door opening to a bigger world. I think that, as a pastry chef, I've always been curious and creative, always want to do more and create new things. The corner just give me an opportunity to show a little bit more of my work, not just with one product, but with the rest. After the corner, I quickly realized that I didn't want my creation to kill my creativity. And I really wanted to move forward and show people what else I've got. You know, as I always say, it's like a singer that comes up with a popular song. You don't want them to sing always the same song forever. You want them to come up with like new songs because you like their style, you like what they do. I think it's the same for a pastry chef, for a chef in general. Like as an artist, you know, we love changes, and that's what I've done. With the after the cornet, so I created what's called the frozen s'mores, and I would say it's one of my base creation as well. The frozen s'mores is essentially like the American s'mores. You know, they're tossing the marshmallow on a campfire with a wooden stick. It's a tradition that is very American. I created an ice cream version of it, which is vanilla ice cream. That's a cube that is coated with a chocolate wafer with a little bit of sea salt, covered with a honey marshmallow, so there's barely any sugar. And it's served on a branch, a wooden branch, that has been smoked with apple wood. And we torch this with a blowtorch to order in front of the guests. So the outside shell, outside of the marshmallow, like creates like a thin shell, almost like a creme brulee that's like beautifully caramelized and golden. So when you bite into it, it's like crunchy, it's chewy, it's cold. There's a lot of different textures, and it's a beautiful creation that speaks for the locals and the things that people grew up with. So it's very emotional. It's a connection between the thought, the food, and the quality and the emotions of people eating it. Right after this, I created what's called the cookie shot. It's a chocolate chip cookie shaped as a shot glass. And inside, we pour milk that is infused with vanilla. So the cookies are warm and the milk is cold. So it's another time to like celebrate American tradition, milk and cookie. It's something that every kid grew up with here in America. And it's a way for me to express creativity through emotions and memories.
Well, it also strikes me that you have taken these really very fundamentally American bakery or sweet treats and kind of infused them with a French perspective and French technique. So you're sort of combining the best of both worlds to create something that's both familiar and new. It really seems to me sort of a great expression of your embracing being American-based.
Absolutely. I think it's the best of both worlds. Of course, the inspiration is the American culture and the tradition. And with this, I always add the French techniques, the recipes, the textures, and sometimes some ingredients as well. Like we use Tahitian vanilla, for example. And it's very important for me to combine both and make like a refined, elegant, beautiful, and tasty version of what they think they might know, or at least recognize, and something still like similar at some time.
Well, I don't think you yet have a bakery in France, but have you gotten feedback from French people on this kind of combination? Because, you know, at one point I felt croissants were sacred in France, and I hate to say this, but my impression is it's becoming, not its existence, but good croissants are becoming an endangered species in France, I think. They're harder and harder to find properly, not sort of industrially influenced one, which I find quite horrifying and depressing. I don't know if that's been your experience, but what sort of things have you found from French customers sampling your wares?
So there's two different things. I always say, like, to comment on the croissant question. I agree with you, like, making beautiful croissant, it's more rare to find a good croissant. I take a lot of pride with our croissant, and in every single of our location around the world, all our chefs are assigned in a procedure for opening the shop to take a cross-section of the croissant and to send photos every morning to me so I can look at the quality and check on the quality of a croissant. So a croissant, you'll tell me it's something simple, yes, but also to me it's very complex. It's something can be so beautiful when it's well done. It should be flaky. It should be it should have a nice, like what we call honeycomb in the center with all these like little like air pockets that defines the texture of the croissant, nice little crust, golden color. So I take a lot of pride with my croissant, and I think it's something very, very important. I don't mess around with my classics, and I like them to be perfect. And, you know, in France, I think that there's still a market that is curious and excited, and a lot more traditional than other places, because culturally bakeries are everywhere, and people you know, go to the bakery growing up like many times a day. So it's not something that you can change too much. But as I'll say that last year I did a pop-up in Paris introducing some of my creations, and it was a huge hit. People loved it because it's new, because it's modern, because it's playful, it's tasty, it's elegant, it's that high quality. So it's everything that French people still appreciate. So bringing something new with a tweak of creativity and introducing some ideas and some thoughts and some emotions through pastry.
And so do you think, because I feel like there's almost two worlds evolving in France. I mean, in Paris, you can still find, because there's very high end and there's money in Paris for, you know, artisanal products. But I think the shame that I'm finding is the artisanal bakers used to be the standard in France, and every village had a baker with, you know, very good croissant, and that started to ebb away. Is that what you see too, that there's sort of these kind of two worlds of croissant kind of emerging within France?
Yeah, that's true. There's a change and a shift into the way that people consume in general. I would say, like, when I was still in France, like 15 years ago, I would see a lot of bread and croissants in supermarkets, and you know, the selection extending like progressively, because, you know, it's easier, I would say, and it's faster, but it's not necessarily better. And nowadays, you see a lot of like younger chefs coming back with more traditions, with more authenticity, and trying to like showcase and not lose the roots of who we are and what we do. Of course, it's more work to make a beautiful croissant fresh every day. Of course, it's harder. Of course, you don't make as much money, but it's what we grew up with, and that's important to keep the tradition and the roots of baking. So there's still a market for this, and there's still people excited about real quality, high quality croissant.
Well, I totally agree. So we'll keep flying the croissant flag. All right, we're going to take a break, and we'll be back to talk to Chef Dominique about his newest book, Everyone Can Bake. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by the Michigan Cherry Committee. A cherry isn't just a cherry. When it comes to tart cherries, the wonderfully U.S.-grown Montmorency tart cherry variety is the cherry with more. They're available year-round, dried, frozen, canned, juice, and concentrate. U.S. Montmorency tart cherries are also one of America's superfruit, which means they're good for you. Tart cherries contain many antioxidants and beneficial phytonutrients, including anthocyanins, the pigments that give tart cherries their bright red color. And don't forget about flavor. U.S. Montmorency's unique sour-sweet profile make them an excellent addition to yogurt, oatmeal, salads, trail mix, and of course, a classic cherry pie. Learn more about the wonderfully U.S.-grown Montmorency tart cherry at choosecherries.com.
Welcome back. We're talking to one of the world's best pastry chefs, Dominique Ancel, about his love of baking and his soon-to-be-published book, Everyone Can Bake, Simple Recipes to Master and Mix. So this new book, I think it's quite interesting because it's very much designed to be approachable and encouraging to everyone. And, you know, certainly I think we haven't talked about as much, we were just talking about the croissant, but which is generally savory, or traditionally savory. Why did you decide to do the next book only on sweet pastry and essentially desserts?
Well, I'm a pastry chef, so 95% of what I do is sweet. I want to show people in this cookbook that the foundations of baking is something that people often forget. And one of the questions I ask people all the time is, what is the first thing you did in the kitchen growing up? And strangely enough, most people will tell you it's something sweet. It's a cookie, it's a pie, it's a tart, it's bread, it's a cake. It's something that you do with your mom, with your grandma. And I found out that people was afraid growing up about baking. And baking is something that is like actually like not too complicated. You just need to be thought the right way. You need the right tools, the right ingredients, and you know, if you step back and think about it, like, people are not afraid of baking and making cookies and cakes because they have someone next to them to tell them what to do and to guide them through each of the steps. So baking is something, you know, I want to showcase, and that's what is showcased in this book.
And yeah, and so you've taken that a step further too, because the book is organized in a very specific way. Can you talk a little bit about this? I called it a building blocks approach to baking that you use in the book.
Yeah, so the building blocks is it's a good term to use. You know, for me, it's a little bit like a kid, like you playing with like Legos. Like you show, you've been shown like what to use first, the foundations of what you're going to build. And in this book, you will find like three different sections. So we'll give you what we call the base. So the base can be anything from a cake to a meringue or like a pie shell, a tart shell. That's the foundation of what we can do. And then we have a second section, which is all the fillings, so all the cream, all the mousses, all the buttercream, ganaches, and all the things that can be used to build the cake and combine everything together. The last section is the finishing. The finishing will show you how to cut fruits, how to glaze, how to decorate cake, how to put everything together to make it beautiful. So those are the three main foundations of what's in the book. And this book not only gives you the foundations, but allow you to mix and match what you feel like eating, what you feel like creating, with some very simple, approachable recipes. So you can do a tart shell with a chocolate filling and let's say some apricots on top. And in all the steps throughout the books, you can find inspirations to finish this cake differently.
Yeah, I felt like the book really follows in this kind of new trend, but I think it's a very good trend of cookbook writers wanting to sort of teach cooking more than just have an assemblage of recipes, so that people come away with the skill to do more themselves rather than just follow one recipe after another. Was that one of your goals as well?
Exactly. I think, working in the kitchen for me for close to 30 years now, what we learn in kitchen, growing in the kitchen, it's very simple, that you are given recipes and you've been told to execute the recipes, to make them, and to make them exactly the same. So at no point you've been taught creativity, which is something I teach in every room of my kitchen. I really want the young chefs to understand what we're doing and why we're doing it and what are all the changes you can and cannot make, and really understand the foundation. So this book is really the opportunity for people to understand and to start thinking how creatively they can pair things together. So of course not everything goes together, but at least you have a good foundations of how to be able to mix and match yourself to make your own creations with still a simple book.
Well, yes, and you can try different things and taste them and know quite quickly whether your creative combination was successful or not.
Exactly. It's also a matter of preference as well. It depends of what you like.
Yes, those are always those great moments on television cooking shows when the contestant has put together their very creative combination, and you look at all three of the judges who are all I'm not sure I've ever had that together, and usually it doesn't work, but occasionally they surprise them.
That's right. It happens too, and it's a learning curve, and for anyone at any level in the kitchen. When you're younger, you try all the things that you might think might work or not. And with experience, with time, you know what doesn't work. So you don't try everything either, but you know what makes sense to combine. It can be in terms of flavors. You like a little bit of acidity with a little bit of sweetness, a little bit of contrast always. And I love contrast, contrast in every form. A contrast of textures. You can have a little creamy, a little crunchy. You can have a different color as well, contrast of color, something like bright red with something dark. And thinking of all of this, of course, with the learning throughout the years, give you an opportunity to be creative on your own way.
I also liked you had an example of learning to make a yogurt cake, I think as a child or as a tween maybe. And I thought that was a great analogy that you used in the book about sort of learning to bake. So tell us, what did you mean by including this? Because I don't think it's a recipe overall in the book, but what is, learning to make a yogurt cake teach one about baking?
Yes, so in France as a kid, yogurt cake is something very, very traditional, I would say, and it's in the tradition of French people to, French parents to teach you when you're a kid, when you work in the kitchen, how to make yogurt cake. So yogurt cake is something very simple. You take a yogurt in a plastic cap, so you empty the two or three yogurts in a mixing bowl, and then you're going to use this yogurt cup as a measuring cup to actually add all your ingredients. So you're going to put 1 cup of sugar, a quarter of a cup of oil, 1 cup of eggs, and 1 cup, half a cup of butter. And you're going to combine all this. It's going to make a perfect, simple yogurt cake. So it's like a sponge cake with yogurt base. It's sweet, it's simple, it's fun to do with kids. It's easy because, you know, you don't have to measure, like, very much. You just need the cup to measure, and it's a great approach to baking in every simple family in France. And it's something that is very memorable for me because it's one of the first things I've done in the kitchen, you know, as a kid. And it was baking with my mom using the cup and my grandma using the cup to measure everything. And I remember, like, once I learn it, I want to do it every weekend. It's something fun. It's something that easy and simple. And it's one of these moments where you realize that, you know, you baked, and you follow steps, and you actually use science and use something simple and fun to do it. And it's what baking is about.
Yeah, I love that. But it leads me to so many questions because you're not, because I think, like, there, what's this standard brand of yogurt and how big is this container? What would your family have used?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's a matter of proportion. Of course, it's a simple yogurt. They're all pretty much the same size. There's like small individual yogurt. Most of I would say dairy company make more or less the same size of yogurt, but it doesn't matter of the size if it's small or big because it's just matter of like proportion, right? So if you have a larger or smaller cup of yogurt, like you can still do the same thing by just following the steps of making yogurt cake.
I see, and it's plain yogurt, right? It doesn't work as well if it's flavored or Greek or anything sort of.
No, we know growing up we never used anything fancy. My dad used to work in a factory, and we didn't have much money, so we're buying the cheapest yogurt that you can buy. They were still good, you know. They are simple, like plain yogurt, and yes, using the cup was just doing the trick for the cake.
I see. Well, I'm looking forward to trying it and seeing, because I'm really curious, because I think that is a tradition. There's many things that are, you know, very sort of American by tradition, like making a box cake from Betty Crocker or one of those. But that tradition I've never had, and I've never had it in France either. So it really struck a chord, and I like the analogy of what such a simple thing teaches you about the science and proportion of baking. I thought it was wonderful.
Yeah, and it's funny because, you know, like I've been in the U.S. for more than 15 years now, and when I see French people tell them about yogurt cake, I see like light in their eyes, and like, oh my God, I remember. Because, you know, as a kid, you do it, it's fun, and then you forget. You don't do it anymore. And it's really like, it's tradition. It's really what it is, and memories. And if you ask a French person, have you done yogurt cake, I can guarantee like at least like 90% of them have done it with their family growing up. And of course, not something you do all the time. But if you're French, you'll do it, and it's more like a bonding time with your kids to really like do something fun, easy, quick, and still like very tasty because they make it with their own hands, and it's when it tastes better. You know, it's those moments that are shared in the kitchen.
Well, I think that's also just very well observed about people's first experiences in the kitchen as a child or with their family. You're right, is very much about making something pastry-like or cake-like or baking or sweet, and that kind of gets disassociated from cooking when it really shouldn't. And it's great that you've joined those things up.
Absolutely, like I think when I grew up in the kitchen, I've learned like cooking and baking, and they're all like very close to each other. I think there's like a divide when it comes to more professional approach to it, because baking is very scientific. And the more professional baking you do, the more extensive baking you do, the more you realize that, you know, it's two different brains that you have to use. The cooking is more like intuitive, it's more like feeling, it's more like depending on the quality ingredients and the seasonality and the seasoning, and you have to adjust, adapt, add a little bit of this and that. And pastry and baking is the opposite. It's just like strict, organized, clean, precise, scientific. And once you learn both and have a chance to do both, because I myself love cooking as much as I love baking, honestly. I love doing both, and I don't see myself doing more one than the other. When I don't bake at work, I cook at home, and I you know, this is what I do for a living. This is what I love doing. So I feel very fortunate to have learned both.
Well, I mean, that's lovely to hear the kind of passion and satisfaction that you come from and your desire to share, you know, both through your bakeries and through your books with others. So I was going to ask you, like, you know, given that this book has a very egalitarian, everybody come join in kind of both title and approach, if they're, you know, for those who check it out or buy it or cook from it, what are there just a couple key things that you hope people, you know, take away from it?
Yes, I think the most important for me is for people to remember to learn how to love baking, to remember that it is not as scary as it seems. I know when you tell people, like, can you bake? They're like, oh, no, my God, I can cook a lot of things, but baking is too complicated for me. But just remember that baking is one of the first things that most people do in the kitchen. Remember that it doesn't have to be scary. It has to be simple. Of course, you might need a scale, right? You might need the proper tools to follow the recipe, read the recipe first, follow all the steps. But once you do it once, you do it a second time, a third time, and then you learn that, you know, it's not that scary. It's just, like, very precise. That's it. It's precise, and I have a lot of satisfaction myself when I do baking to have exactly perfectly the same result. And I know it because I follow the recipe, because I follow all the steps, because I don't change, I don't vary anything. And it's an extension of cooking. Like I say, it's a little bit more technical. But it's, you know, what I want people to get from this book is for them to not be afraid of baking first, and then to look at those beautiful and simple recipes that can make people happy, and find a way for them to like dive inside and find their own creativity by flipping the pages of the book and see what they feel like matching together.
Well, that all sounds very encouraging. So let us know, what is your yogurt cake story? What was your favorite thing to bake as a child, and what would you relish going back to but haven't had in a while? Tell us what your best baking victory story is. Send us an email or even a voice memo to contact@juliachildfoundation.org and let us know. After the break, Dominique reveals his Julia moment. We'll be right back.
When you flip anything, you just have to have the courage of your convictions, particularly if it's sort of a loose mass like this. Well, that didn't go very well. See, when I flipped it, I didn't have the courage to do it the way I should have. But you can always pick it up, and if you're alone in the kitchen, who is going to see?
From Julia's immortal words, we move into our last segment, which we call the Julia moment. Here's when we ask our guests to share their favorite Julia memory moment or how she's inspired them in their career. Dominique, your turn. What's your Julia moment?
So my Julia moment, I would say, I grew up in France. I grew up with learning French culture, and I only moved in the U.S. When I was 28, almost 30 years old. And I've learned about Julia, of course. I've learned through her books. I've learned through her TV show. And the most memorable thing is when I went to the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C., and they had recreated the whole kitchen, Julia's kitchen, in the museum. And I remember that the counter was quite tall at the time. And I was mesmerized because I know Julia was, I think, 6'2", 6'3". She was a pretty tall woman. So all her kitchen counter were, like, much taller. And I was fascinated by all the tools and, the size of the kitchen. First, it was very, very small. There was a moment where I realized that, you know, back then, we didn't have much. We didn't have as much as we have today in terms of technology, you know, even like just a scale. It was much harder to bake. It was much harder to, the ovens were not as precise as they are today. The science and technology was not as developed. So back then, it was still like they were still doing some great meal. And I'm sure Julia has made some amazing meals in her kitchen. But when you go back in time a little bit, and you see this actual, physically see this kitchen with what she had to cook, it was probably like pretty amazing to pull out some great meal.
No, that's great. Well, I'm thrilled that you've been to visit her kitchen. And just to clarify, for those who may not know, it's not a recreation. That is literally piece by piece her actual kitchen moved to the Smithsonian. They took it apart and shipped it down. All right. Well, Dominique, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your stories and teaching us about Everyone Can Bake. We're looking forward to it coming out.
Thank you, Todd. Thank you for having me on the show today.
A pleasure. And thanks, everyone, for listening. The book is Everyone Can Bake, Simple Recipes to Master and Mix by Dominique Ancel, with Mouth-Watering Photography by Evan Sung. It will be published by Simon & Schuster on April 14th, 2020. Search for it online or ask for it at your favorite local bookseller. To keep up with Dominique's latest innovations, check out at dominique.ancel.bakery on Facebook, and you can follow at Dominique Ancel, all one word, on Twitter and Instagram. For more details on his bakery and wares, go to dominiqueancel.com. We're at Julia Child on Facebook and at Julia Child Foundation on Instagram. It's at Julia Child JCF, and I'm at T. Shulkin on Twitter. The Julia Child audio clip from The French Chef is used with permission from our friends at WGBH. Thanks to my co-producer of the foundation, Lauren Salkeld, and our sound engineer at Heritage Radio Network, Amanda Wang. Our theme song is New French Horn by Novi Valtorni. Please remember to give us a review. It really helps new listeners discover the show. We're on the air on Heritage Radio Network on Thursdays at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, with downloads available soon after wherever you find your podcasts. We look forward to bringing you back into the Foundation's world next time on Inside Julia's Kitchen.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter. Our handle is @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.